tonight on NBC.
Will everyone in the cardiac surgical department please raise your hands? Thank you. You're all fired.
Based on an inspiring true story.
Any department who places billing above care, you will be terminated.
One doctor will break every rule.
Just tell me what you need, what your patients need.
To inspire a revolution.
Let's get into some trouble. Let's be doctors. Again.
From the network that brings you This Is Us, New Amsterdam, tonight on NBC.
This podcast is brought to you by Simply Light.
Introducing Simply Light Lemonade. Can you hear that? That's the sweet sound of 75% less sugar and calories. We want to make sure you hear it's 75% less sugar and calories because it tastes so good.
Delicious food that's more wholesome and at the same time costs less.
Betty Crocker cake mixes bake perfect cakes. When your husband can talk...
Although the ration was intended to provide sufficient food to sustain five men for one day...
You're listening to The Feast, where history is served with a dash of hot sauce or a squeeze of lemon, where we look behind those dates and names everyone knows to the meals that made them. I'm your host, Laura Carlson, and each week we're bringing you stories of how revolutions can start at lunch counters or how empires can end over dessert. Some of the biggest moments in history happened over dinner, and we are giving you a seat at the table. This is a podcast where meals make history. You know the story of Hansel and Gretel, don't you? Two children, abandoned in a dark German forest, stumble upon a house made entirely and impossibly out of sweets, with a roof made of cake and windows of spun sugar. Now, in this story, it's a witch's house, built to lure children to their certain doom. But did you ever wonder where the story came from? Sure, it might be every kid's dream to stumble onto a house made entirely of candy, but that doesn't mean people haven't attempted it. In 2012, the famously inventive English chef Heston Blumenthal built a pub entirely out of meat pies, including a pool table made out of fish with pickled eggs for balls. Well, that may have been one unusual case, but Blumenthal's Porky Pub wasn't the first to realize the dream of a world literally made of food. A popular folk song from the 1920s in America dreamed of a paradise where food fell from the skies.
In the big rock candy mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Big Rock Candy Mountain, first recorded by Harry McClintock in 1928, became a Billboard success only in the 1930s, at the height of the Great Depression, when more than a few Americans found the song's promise of free and abundant food an appealing one. But whether it was folk songs or fairy tales, these were just fantasies, right? Not necessarily. Today, we'll take a look at how 18th century Naples made those dreams a reality on a pretty regular basis. And as we'll see, just like in Hansel and Gretel, these early modern monuments of food often came with a very high price tag. And it wasn't just the Neapolitans who were building these early modern equivalents of Porky Pubs or candied witches' cottages. We'll also be visiting the Detroit Institute of the Arts, the current host of an entire exhibition on early modern edible monuments. We'll speak to Dr. Alan Darr, head of European Sculpture and Decorative Arts, who'll show us the books dedicated to capturing and preserving these monumental food fantasies, the food lover's Instagram feed of its day. Whether that was a print of a 6-foot-long sugar sculpture in the shape of a Greek temple, the coveted guest list of an exclusive feast at the Versailles Gardens, or a step-by-step guide on how exactly one should build an archway out of salami. All that and more, today on The Feast. Charlotte, the freshly minted Queen of Naples, was exhausted. The celebration of her marriage to Ferdinand, the King of Naples, had been going on for more than a month. There had been banquets, operas, dances, masked balls, fireworks, all things a 16-year-old royal like Charlotte usually adored. But in this case, all those feasts and festivities had taken her permanently from her beloved home in Austria to the wilds of southern Italy, to a husband she had never met and who was known throughout Europe as an uneducated, uncivilized boor. But she was a Habsburg, and like her mother before her, Maria Theresa, the formidable Empress of the Holy Roman Empire, she knew what was expected of her. So when the Bourbon King of Spain offered up his second son, the heir to the throne of Naples, as a potential match for a Habsburg daughter, ending decades of tense peace and more often than not opened warfare between the two families, Charlotte could hardly refuse. She was the 13th child of Maria Theresa and Emperor Francis I, and a girl to boot. She could hardly expect better fortunes than being offered the crown of Naples. And to be honest, her mother had made it quite clear that refusing the match wasn't really an option. The wedding had been the usual royal affair, a quick proxy marriage ceremony at the palace in Austria, with her own younger brother standing in for the absent bridegroom Ferdinand, and then Charlotte was off to southern Italy, to be greeted formally by the Neapolitan king just inside the kingdom's borders. So here she stood, next to her new husband, on the balcony of the Neapolitan royal palace, waving to the crowds. It was June 5th of 1768, a warm day, and the breezes drifting in from the sea helped to cool the thousands of Neapolitans, not to mention European dignitaries and nobles, who had turned up for the biggest spectacle of them all. Sure, there had been balls and feasts to celebrate the wedding, but those had been for the nobility, for the elite. Today would be all about the people, the some 395,000 Neapolitans who didn't have a title to their name. Today was the day of the Cucagna. Charlotte had heard stories about this cherished local tradition, but had never seen one for herself. She had assumed they were like any of the other fanciful banquet creations so in vogue at courts throughout Europe, where lavish centerpieces, even entire backdrops for a meal, could take months to create. But something today seemed different. Below her, on the open plaza before the palace, a giant fortress had been constructed. But it was unlike any fortress Charlotte had ever seen. Instead of stone or mortar, the fortress, which rose 20, maybe 30 feet into the air, was entirely covered with food. Roast meat and loaves of bread crisscrossed to make the fortress walls. In the tower hung an unlikely bell made entirely of cheese. Cakes provided the windows, wine flowed from the parapets. It was one giant banquet in fortress form. And around the fortress, the bounty continued, wandering amongst trees made of bologna sausage and fruit flowers were live oxen, geese, ducks, and pigs. A living, if unlikely, tableau. At the king's command, men heaved buckets into the fortress's moat, flooding the thing with water. Meanwhile, others tipped pails of live fish in. Charlotte could just make out their silvery forms from her place high on the balcony. It was a spectacle unlike any she had ever seen. But it wasn't over yet. With a glimmer in his eye, the king raised his hand, holding a fluttering white handkerchief high over his head. At first, Charlotte thought this was to summon more wonders to appear. Maybe fireworks, even. But as the king dropped his hand, the plaza erupted into chaos. The crowd, which had been watching the royal presentation, rushed at the monument. Suddenly, thousands of Neapolitans were besieging the edible fortress. There were those who simply attacked the base, contenting themselves with a sausage tree or a brick of bread. But the more daring stormed the moat, wading through the fish to climb the fortress itself. It wasn't an easy job. The fortress was crumbling in front of Charlotte's eyes as the crowd tore into the food, the climb to the cheesy bell tower increasingly precarious as its bready foundations were torn away. Before long, there was little left of the beautiful monument. A few half-eaten loaves of bread, cakes that had been trampled underfoot in the crush. The cheesy bell tower lay in ruins, and the parapets had been quickly emptied of wine. Even the live animals, the oxen, ducks, fish, and pigs, had been snatched away from the tower scene, sometimes violently, taken back to Neapolitan homes, where meat was a scarce luxury. Charlotte may have expected the king to summon the guards after such a scene, clapping the mob into chains for destroying the monument to the royal wedding, which must have taken months to create. But what she had just seen had all gone, with excuses to the fish, swimmingly to plan. This was the Cucania, a living embodiment of a medieval legend of a land of plenty, where food rained from the skies, with rivers of wine and trees made of cheese and salami. Distantly related to the word for cooking in Latin, cucere, variations on the myth of the land of endless cakes and wine could be found throughout Europe. It was known in English as the land of cocaine. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, it was a popular subject for painters, including a particularly famous work by the 16th century Dutch master Peter Bruegel. In his work, simply called The Land of Cocaine, overindulged peasants, clerics, and knights lie on the ground, overwhelmed by the abundance around them. Surrounding them are trees made of bread, homes with roofs made of pastries and cakes. A half-eaten egg with legs runs between them, inviting them to eat even more. We'll put up a link to the painting on our website if you want to see this medieval land of plenty for yourselves. Bruegel's painting was an easy metaphor for the dangers of gluttony. But some regions took the lessons beyond just simple paintings. In Italy, printers and illustrators didn't have to imagine what the land of Cucania looked like. They had plenty of inspiration from a vibrant living tradition. Festivals that brought the mythical land to life with abundant food and drink. Italian prints from these times capture some of the regular events one might find at local Cucania celebrations. We asked Dr. Alan Darr, head of European Sculpture and Decorative Arts at the Detroit Institute of the Arts, to tell us a bit about the Cucania tradition in Italy.
In Italy in particular, I think probably also in Europe, but particularly in Italy, in Milan and Florence and Rome, especially in Naples, it gets like totally, you know, monumental. Structures are made out of sort of ephemeral papier-mâché and some temporary architectural setting that would then be laden with breads and prosciuttos and cheeses, and there would be poles that were greased. If you look carefully, you see they are filled with game birds or fowl. So if you could get yourself up this greased pole, you could then take home a nice roasted duck or grouse or something. But you can see at the bottom of some of these, people are just sprawling on the ground and on top of each other and couldn't make it, you know, just couldn't get up the greased pole. So there was a colored print of Cucania, and we translated the Italian because it's quite amusing. So in the land of Cucania, here it rains pearls and diamonds. Mines of money and gold coins for anyone to take. Trees with all kinds of macerated fruits or elaborately cut fruits. Lakes of meatballs and salami. Plains of marzipan and candy. A river of Spanish wine. Horses with saddles and bridles. Whoever wants them may take them.
This podcast is brought to you by Simply Light.
Introducing Simply Light Lemonade. Can you hear that? That's the sweet sound of 75% less sugar and calories. We want to make sure you hear it's 75% less sugar and calories because it tastes so good.
Tins of gold, ships and galleys of Bologna, loaded with salted meats. This plant produces cakes and pastries. cows in this land bear calves every month. This lake continually serves up cooked fish of all sorts. Hills of fine sugar cakes, lakes of fritters, cannons which fire flasks of Moscato wine, or it's a sweet wine, harbors of lazy people, for the slackers, ships transporting all sorts of good, the famous Cucaña Mountain, a prison for those who prefer to work, a moat of good Greek wine, bridges made of melon slices, lakes of fresh wine, spears of roast veal. This is Mr. Panignon, the most lazy and thus the master of this land. It's raining all kinds of cooked poultry, so the cooked poultry come down from the sky, land on your plate already cooked, so you don't have to wait. While dining, it rains capons, partridges, and all sorts of game. Trees that produce all sorts of fresh fruits, a cave of ravioli, ovens in which fresh loaves of bread are baking continuously. In this country, donkeys are yoked with sausages. And then finally, he's going to prison for working.
Stories about the land of cocaine often came heavy-handed with a moral about the dangers of gluttony or laziness. And the festivals in Italy that brought this land to life often were no different. Held right before Lent, Cucaña festivals could be the last gasp of fun before the 40 days of penitence and prayer leading up to Easter. Not so different from modern traditions of Mardi Gras or Pancake Day. But the Cucaña festival could have other, more political messages too. Italian governments had learned centuries ago, you can convince people of just about anything if you give them a bit of food or wine and something entertaining to watch. Think of Rome's famous bread and circuses. So it wasn't long before governments started getting involved in the Cucaña festivals, using the celebrations of food to advertise their own political messages. And nowhere was this more evident than in 18th century Naples. Within the kingdom, the earliest celebrations of the Cucaña had been giant mobile floats, just like you'd see at Mardi Gras, but built by the city's food guilds, bands of butchers, cheesemakers, and bakers. Because what better advertisement for your local butcher or cheese shop than a giant display of your wares, paraded and sampled by the entire city's population? It was also a great show of goodwill and generosity, helping to feed the people of the city. But it was only a matter of time before the government realized they could get in on the action. And in Naples, the government needed all the goodwill it could get. You see, Naples was in an interesting political position. It had been a kingdom for most of the medieval and early modern period, but it was rarely independent. It had a prime spot on the Mediterranean, perfect for merchants traveling east or west. It was perfect for staging crusades, for example, or for keeping an eye on the Pope in Rome. Basically, the location was useful for just about everything. So, understandably, perhaps, the various powers of Europe had been fighting over this little kingdom for the better part of 1,000 years. And in the 17th and 18th centuries, two powers in particular, Spain and Austria, had deadlocked over control of it. First Spain ruled it, then Austria, then Spain, all through governmental officials known as viceroys, representatives of whichever crown happened to be in control of Naples at the time. But with all this back and forth of power, the Neapolitans themselves had been lost in the shuffle. Although one of the biggest cities in Europe at the time, rivaling the population of Paris or London, Naples was also considered one of the poorest, with the lowest literacy rate in Europe, and most people living a knife edge away from absolute poverty. The viceroys, needing to keep the population happy with the government, soon took to insisting on governmental oversight of the Cucaña celebrations. This started out simply. By the early 1600s, this meant Neapolitans saw the silver eagles of the Austrian Empire atop each of the floats as they passed by. Nothing too extreme. But after popular revolts, the government took the next step, requiring that the Cucaña floats could only be paraded in the square in front of the royal palace, where the viceroy himself was given the honor of opening the festivities each year, giving the signal to the gathered crowds that they could start eating the monuments, an explicit expression of control. And when the power dynamic changed yet again in Naples, when the Spanish ousted the Austrian government in the early 1700s, even more changes were made to the festivities. The new Spanish viceroy required that Cucaña floats had to be stationary, effectively ending any ties to the traditional parade. The city's food guilds, which once had been responsible for the event, now found themselves unwelcome at the festivities. To try to earn as much goodwill as possible, the new government insisted they would be exclusively responsible for the entire Cucaña celebration, building one giant edible monument in the plaza before the royal palace, an ultimate symbol of both control and generosity. Not that everything always went to plan. As the government assumed more and more control of the monument, the invitation for the city's population to attack or eat the monument also grew increasingly rowdy. Brawls erupted as people fought over the monument's food. People used knives to cut away the bread and cheese, and accidents were inevitable. In the 1730s, the Spanish king, then ruler of Naples, even felt obliged to set up a fund for the widows and orphans which had resulted from that year's Cucaña festival. As one onlooker said, while the Romans had given the people bread and circuses, the Neapolitan government gave its people feste, farine, forche, feasts, flour, and gallows. All this made the wedding in 1768 between Charlotte of Austria and Ferdinand of Spain all the more hopeful. With a marriage alliance between the two powers which had been warring over Naples for the better part of two centuries, the trials of the kingdom were hopefully finally over. The reign of Charlotte and Ferdinand could hopefully usher in a time of peace and prosperity for the Neapolitans. Although that didn't mean an immediate end to the Cucaña violence, even on the royal wedding day in early June of 1768. Charlotte supposedly fainted dead away when she saw the crowds tear into the Cucaña monument dedicated to her marriage. And following her wedding, she was among the loudest voices to implement regulations on any future Cucaña monuments, forbidding the use of live animals to adorn the scenes, as they were often the first victims of the crowds. Queen Charlotte proved to be as savvy a political leader as her mother, Maria Theresa. While her husband Ferdinand pursued hunting and gambling, she gained a seat on the Privy Council of Naples in 1775, following the birth of her son and heir. From then, Charlotte was effectively the sole ruler of Naples and dedicated herself to the revival of this small but powerful kingdom. She revived court life, patronizing international artists. And she didn't shirk from the increasingly unstable political situation of Europe. When France erupted into revolution in 1789, which saw the arrest and eventual execution of her younger sister, Marie Antoinette, Charlotte threw herself into campaigns against the country, fighting first against the new French Republic and eventually Napoleon for the next two decades. Although Napoleon eventually conquered Naples, forcing Charlotte to abandon her adopted country, he was apparently so impressed by her resolve that he called her, quote, the only man in the kingdom of Naples. But what about the Cucaña? Although elaborate banquets and festivals continued under her reign, Queen Charlotte brought about an end to the tradition as it had existed under the Neapolitan viceroys in 1778, effectively giving the festival back to the city itself, where it continued as a part of the annual carnival celebrations, as it had started centuries before. Stories about the land of cocaine continued into the 1800s, although their prominence in cultural legends and folklore soon waned, eventually popping up as set pieces about warnings of gluttony, as in Hansel and Gretel's Candied Witch's Cottage, featured in the Brothers Grimm. But there's definitely something about a land of endless food and drink that captures our imagination even today. From folk songs from the Great Depression, children's games such as Candyland, and even in Willy Wonka's Magical Chocolate Factory, where literally everything is made of sweets. So maybe the land of Cucaña is as close as ever. And for a short time, it's even closer than you think. If you're near Detroit before April 16th, you can visit the Edible Monuments exhibition on at the Detroit Institute of the Arts, where a wealth of prints and illustrations on Cucaña and other early modern feasting traditions are on display. Organized and developed by Marsha Reed and the Getty Research Institute, the Edible Monument Exhibition brings together some of the best examples of Europe's early festivals and feasting, including a 5-foot-long sugar sculpture that once adorned a royal table. Here's Alan Darr again, organizer of the exhibition at the DIA.
So the prints and the books you see in the exhibition basically were created for the rulers, or the people throwing the parties. Not always rulers, but like there's senators and an ambassador from England to the court of Rome that would organize these amazing events. So the first part of the exhibition is essentially divided into three parts, but the first part is about the courtly and the civic feasts, the festivals and the feasts that would sometimes take 10 months to prepare and be consumed in a day or a couple of days. So we hope more people will come and enjoy the experience. And I know it's been very well received by large numbers of the population, and people are enjoying learning about something they knew nothing about. While I would encourage your listeners to come to the Detroit Institute of Arts and see this exhibition, which is free in our print and drawing Schwartz Family Galleries on the ground floor. It's free as our other print and drawing exhibitions. And so it's open until Easter, April the 16th.
You can also purchase the exhibition catalog online, which talks more about the prints and drawings on display, as well as the history of the Cucaña celebration. We'll put a link to it on our website. And if you find yourself around the Detroit area, I can't recommend the exhibition enough. On now until April 16th. And don't just head to the exhibition. The DIA is a great place to wander for hours, if not days. Beyond the edible monuments, they have plenty of things dedicated to great dinners throughout history. The Feast is written and produced by me, Laura Carlson. Technical direction by Mike Port. And a huge thank you this week to the folks at the Detroit Institute of the Arts, including, of course, Dr. Alan Darr, who was kind enough to talk to us about the exhibition and the DIA. We'll put a link to the Edible Monument exhibition on our website, as well as other information about the Cucaña and the reign of Queen Charlotte of Naples. Find out more by visiting www.thefeastpodcast.org. Music featured today includes works by Andy Cohen, Jazar, Harry McClintock, the United States Army Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps, Philip Weigel, and the Sony Ventorum Wind Quintet. That's all for us this week. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with more great meals that made history. I'm Laura Carlson, and this is The Feast.